Hello, Will.
Hey, Rohan, you okay?
It's been a while.
It has been a while. It's a shame that we haven't been able to do this more often. I think it must have been a couple of months since our last one.
Yeah, it was actually, yeah, I remember the moment very clearly was when I decided I had a wedding to plan in about 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Which suddenly just came up to me, you know, just not like I planned it.
Yeah, arguably more important and definitely a much better way for you to be spending your time planning your wedding than just doing a chat with me.
Yeah, well, my wife certainly thinks so.
Yeah, fair enough.
I hear you've entered a new chapter of your life as well.
I have, yeah. I mean, no, I think a lot has changed since we last did this for both of us. Mm. But yes, yeah, so I am exactly 1 week into my master's in neuroscience. And it's going well, learning quite a lot. It's been, we've got our neuroanatomy exams in about 4 or 5 weeks. So they, loaded in pretty hard and pretty quick on that side of things. But yeah, it's been good. So I've been in Southampton for about 2 weeks. The first week was just to sort of meet people and get involved with stuff. And then the second week is actual degree work. So yeah, it's been going okay. It's been going okay.
What does have you started your neuroanatomy stuff yet?
I have, yes.
When I was doing it in second year, essentially, it boiled down to you were given lots of slices of brain, essentially. And they then just asked you to identify various bits. And generally the only thing you had to go by was just which shade of grey it was. So that's okay. My general advice to you is you look very carefully at
get used to the shades.
Yeah, there's at least three different shades of grey that you need to. I mean, I wouldn't go as far as saying there's 50, but there's at least three that I know.
So the typically in my course we would have a weekly like workshop in the hospital with brains. However, given what's going on, we have been deprioritized from being able to go to the hospital. So instead, our practicals are in like a classroom just with brain models rather than real brains.
Okay.
And I think I was asking, you know, what are the differences when you're using a real brain? And I think in the models, it's a lot clearer where everything is, because obviously you don't have like the individual variation. It's all very like textbook. Very obvious. So I imagine that will make things a bit easier, but will also mean if in a couple of years time I'm ever using real brains, I'm just gonna be screwed. I won't know what's going on.
It's unlikely you'll be looking at brains, slices of brains in that unless you're like a radiologist or something.
Yeah, I mean, what's more likely, I suppose, is if I was doing a research project and but like using individual cells or small amounts of tissue, it's not going to be whole brains, really. I'd be surprised.
When I was in Cambridge as a med student, they had this one brain which was like the envy of all the med students, and it was a brain without a cerebellum. So essentially it was missing like a big chunk. What people generally tend to think of as a brain. But apparently the guy was absolutely fine because he just never had one from birth. So it just shows like the remarkable plasticity of the kind of, you know, high level.
Was there something else there instead? Had the space been grown into by just more?
Yeah, cortex, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But it's strange, isn't it? Because you think like such a crucial part missing, but you just compensate with time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I think they say, you know, there are various people who do just have holes in their brain. And they won't realize until they're, you know, maybe they volunteer for a study, for an MRI study. Yeah. And then they're looking at the data and they hold on, something's not quite right there. But you can just get on with it. It is a very plastic system, if so long as your whole or your lack of cerebellum is from the start rather than midway through. Even if, you know, even if you sort of lose something, you often, you know, the plasticity is still there, like the people who lose a sense, like their sight or their hearing, you still see the brain being recruited for other stuff.
It's basically the plot of Daredevil, wasn't it? Like
when you realize the Marvel writers did their homework.
So what have you got for us this week?
Well, so I think we, given your the fantastic entry that you've got in the Guardian with that article, we're going to talk a bit about what's going on in the application process at the moment. I think our last chat was the zombie one, so I think it's only fair that we then do a more...
Come back full circle.
Yeah, I think it's good to alternate one more about the education system, one more about other stuff. So yeah, talking about how things are changing. I mean, we talk a lot in our open days about how things have changed with COVID, but I'm not sure we've talked about that too much on this podcast.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because just the last few years have just been full of uncertainty on the education landscape.
Yeah.
And it's just whatever repercussions started, they'll have knock-on effects for many years to come, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But I think it's only this year we're starting to see like the real effects of it. So if you look at the data from last year alone, the number of medical school applicants increased by about 20%.
Yeah.
And that's to be expected, right? Like the Guardian loves, I think the journalist I was speaking to,
quote,
which is when there's a war, everyone wants to be a doctor. But when there's a pandemic, everyone wants to be a soldier. But when there's a pandemic, everyone wants to be a doctor.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, we've seen some signs of this. I was speaking to a couple of students, both very similar situation, both applying for medicine, and both spurred into it because of what they'd seen.
The second
one, unfortunately, realized he basically couldn't. He wanted the glory without the hard work. You know, when he kind of realized how much hard work medicine is, he actually promptly withdrew from applying. But I think it just goes to illustrate that it's not just competition that's increasing. It's not just more people applying that's causing the competition to increase. It's the fact that places are essentially staying stagnant, which means that because places aren't changing, the ratio of competitive applications gets harder and harder.
Yeah.
And that's not just medicine. If you think about Oxbridge, in the 80s, there were only about 5,000 applicants to Oxbridge.
Oh, wow.
There were roughly a few thousand spaces. So it's like it really wasn't that competitive.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, you know, obviously more and more UK students are wanting to do degrees, but also I think there's even an even greater pull internationally. There are the sort of big universities in the States where they have acceptance rates of like 5% or something like that. And that seems pretty nuts to us over here, but actually I think that's probably the way that it's going. Cause as you say, the universities can't grow at the rate that, applicant pools are growing. So it's, I don't really think it's going to sort of stop as well. Obviously it's shot up over the pandemic, but I think actually, more and more people are going to want to go to university. You know, it's seen as a relatively reliable and safe thing to do.
Yeah.
So particularly when the last couple of years, people have found jobs difficult to find and things like that. It's even become an even more, well, this is just what I should do because it's a safe thing to do. And then I, get a career out of it as well. And I don't think that's going to go away. I think that's only going to strengthen.
Yeah, absolutely. And, there's a, often, particularly graduates, I think you've just said, they'll come out of into a job market that's actually incredibly crowded. And actually, look, it's not worth it. I can't seem to find a job. Let me go do a master's or a PhD. Bad timing, I suppose, with you. But, your circumstance is very different. Well, but I think there's a multifactorial thing. So, yes, there's been this background of increasing competition over the last decade anyway. But like with a lot of things, COVID just accelerated that phenomena. Yeah. Probably what we would have seen in 10 years, we've seen in 2 years instead.
Yeah.
It's interesting in terms of the places have stayed relatively stagnant. I know the GMC and kind of there was a big political whitewashing, I suppose, is probably a good way, where they said they're going to increase places by 500, but then some of the universities who got the extra places said that they didn't, even though they got more spaces and funding, they didn't literally have space
to
train and all facilities to train more medics. So they didn't actually end up taking them on in the end.
Okay. I mean, there are, what, there was a new medical school in 2019. I think there's there's another four or five on review on the GMC's review list. So there are more medical schools cropping up. But like you say, it's often not the fact that there's not enough university space. So this is medicine specific, but there's not enough hospital space to be able to train them. And, you know, you need sort of a Goldilocks zone for this, because you need a university which is big enough to have a medical school surrounded by large enough hospitals to have teaching capacity. And, you know, theoretically, there's lots of hospitals in the UK, but actually to get those perfect circumstances together, it doesn't happen that often. And where it has happened, there's already a, you know, there's already a university there. So it's sort of, you've used up the opportunities that you have.
Yeah, and clinical teaching is not straightforward. You know, it's not like it's not like undergraduate teaching where you're trying to teach someone neuroanatomy, which is relatively prescriptive. You can just put them into a lecture theatre and go through a topic from A to Z, and it's relatively straightforward. Whereas clinical teaching, it's you just don't know what's going to come up or walk through the door. So it's a lot more unpredictable, and therefore requires extra time.
Yeah,
as a result, I suppose in terms of competitiveness, though, it's not just the fact that there are more applicants. It's also the fact that because there's more applicants, medical schools are more likely to essentially move the goalposts. What do you think about that?
Well, and, you know, there are more applicants, and also sort of there's been pretty, well, just the way that applicants are assessed has changed quite a lot. You know, this year people are hopefully going to be sitting exams, but for the last couple of years people haven't. You know, this cohort doesn't have GCSEs. Last year's cohort didn't actually sit their A levels, so there's lots of stuff going on. And you know, it's only natural that if the grades are getting higher and more people are applying, then the universities, particularly ones that have, you know, lots more applicants than places, they are going to start demanding more effectively out of their students.
Yeah. And, you know, we talk a lot about Oxbridge and med school, Will, but do you think we'll start seeing signs there? I mean, I'm a firm believer that I think that phenomena will become widespread across not just Oxbridge, med schools, law schools, but also potentially we'll start seeing this in Russell Group universities generally.
So I think the one that I think will be next, or the main subject where I see the competition being really high, is actually computer science. I think it's one of the most oversubscribed subjects at Cambridge, but outside of Cambridge, sort of looking at UCL, Imperial, those kind of, you know, top Russell Group universities, they're very, very oversubscribed.
Yeah.
And I actually think it's quite ludicrous that they don't have an admissions test, because, you know, you're judging it based on A levels and personal statement, and A levels people aren't actually sitting, and the personal statement actually to me doesn't really seem like hugely important for computer science in particular. You know, there are tried and tested ways of testing someone's sort of capacity for a degree like computer science, and I think it's just a matter of time before those universities start using it all the time.
It's really, I promise we've not staged this, but genuinely, Will, Imperial have started using an admissions test for engineering as of this year.
Okay.
Which is just a really new development. And, and you know, they've also started using the MAT, the maths test, the Oxford applicants have to say.
Yeah.
So those tests are becoming, you know, kind of more mainstream, essentially. And I just wonder, there may come a point similar to what, like we have with the LMAT and the UCAT, where every law or medical applicant has to take them. I wonder if they'll make them a point when just every computer science applicant, regardless of university, will have to take a CSAO or an MAT equivalent.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you think about why those tests were introduced originally, they were introduced originally because there were lots of people applying. There's a huge ceiling effect on grades. And, you know, the personal statement actually isn't an overly useful tool. It's helpful. You can get a sense of a student, but it doesn't actually tell you that much about someone. And so they needed it to be able to actually differentiate between who was who. And that is now not just a problem at Oxford and Cambridge. It's sort of becoming a problem everywhere, but particularly for those difficult subjects. So, yeah, I think obviously, you know, medicine, they've done it for a while. Law's doing it as well. Interesting that engineering now are having to do it too. But it's just going to be, I think computer science as well is a really, really popular course at the moment. The alternative is they just have a very bad way of picking people, which isn't a good way to do it from the university's perspective.
Yeah, I think, you know, people often get a bit annoyed at some of these selective universities saying they make them jump through all these hoops.
Yeah.
But actually, it's if you kind of put yourselves in the admissions tutor's shoes, which I appreciate is quite a difficult thing to do, is to empathize with someone at that age, stature. But it's actually really hard for them to tell everyone apart because they all have, you know, I think 70% of applicants to Cambridge Science subjects now have 3A stars. So it's just so particular. And that was pre-COVID. So gosh, it must be like almost 80-90% now. So it's just so hard for them to try. So it'd almost be irresponsible for them to basically pick lots or pick straws at that point.
Yeah. But I think also, you know, when there is a test, when there are things like that, it's really clear how you're being assessed. And it's really clear, like, that you can do something about it.
Yeah.
Whereas it's a bit more nebulous when there's just sort of a personal statement and that's sort of it.
It's so easy to lie on these personal statements as well. I mean, we've seen so many instances and we've kind of caught people out on them.
Yeah. I remember I've spoken to someone who said that they lied on their personal statements and, you know, and they weren't picked up on it. And so it is easy to make stuff up.
We'll have to refer them
definitely
to,
not endorsing it. Like, don't lie on your personal statements, anyone who's listening. But, you know, I don't think it's a reliable way to make an assessment of someone. Because you can say whatever you like in it, basically.
Yeah, and it is hard. I mean, if you think about last year, there were about 30,000 offers given out for medical schools. There's only about 7,500 places. Mm. So the other thing that's supposed to happen is some applicants had a lot more offers. You know, typically medical schools will have like a reserve ratio. So let's say Birmingham, for instance, 800 places, they'll give out about 1,500 offers. And because they know half of their applicants will go elsewhere.
Yeah.
But last year, because people got less offers than normal, the number of people who ended up accepting their offers ended up being higher. I'm picking on Birmingham. It could be any university, but let's say again, Birmingham gave out 1,500 offers. Maybe they ended up with 1,200 who ended up staying. And that's actually, it was in the news a few months ago about Exeter.
Yeah.
That's exactly the reason why Exeter had to essentially pay students 10 grand to defer to next year. So all they're doing is just kicking the can down the road because they're going to have that same problem now in the 2022 cycle.
Yeah. It doesn't resolve itself just because COVID goes away.
No.
You know,
there's two scenarios where it resolves itself, right? Like one is the number of applicants goes down or number two is there's more places. Well, there's a big lag time with the second option, like places don't suddenly become available. Like the whole process of creating a medical school, launching it takes 5 years. It
takes forever,
minimum, especially longer, potentially longer with GMC approval. And it's unlikely that applications will go down based on what we've been seeing. If anything, they'll continue to rise.
Yeah, it is interesting. Deferrals is a big thing. It sort of compounds the issue, but also it's a really difficult thing to measure. As far as I know, or I'm not aware of a sort of a message board where you can see the number of people who have got sort of deferred places. Is that available for students to check out?
No, not easily. I think you can put it. I mean, we've done a few of freedom information requests, but that's obviously, you know, it's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah. So you know, I've spoken to students and they've said that they've heard, you know, that X medical school has a lot of people deferring to the following year. But that's not a very solid source of information to be basing your medical school choices on. You know, so that's another hidden thing that students can't really assess very accurately. And it could, but it could theoretically cause serious problems for them.
And, you know, we've been talking a lot about the numbers and trends, but the other thing to mention here is that the quality of the applicants, I think, is probably better than it was 5 years ago. And what I mean by that is, one, they are better prepared.
Mm.
And two, I think they invest a lot more time in their applications now than they've done in the past. So
yeah.
I always talk about this as when I applied for medicine, I was a bit of a nerd. I think I was pretty, you know, I knew every bone in the body, which I think was way overkill when I applied. But actually, back then, there was only one past paper for the BMAT. That was publicly available. And yes, I did it three times, but there was only so much to be gained from doing any more times. Whereas now there's 15 years of past papers available.
Yep.
And the best applicants we're seeing, because they've got so much time over the summer, they've not had to go on any exotic holidays. They've just been knuckling down and doing all these papers. Some applicants I've spoken to, it's unbelievable. They've done every single past paper twice, plus my book, plus all the other textbooks. So it's, the level of preparation they're displaying is remarkable. And I don't think the BMAT question complexity has changed, but I think the kind of gradings have changed quite a bit. So back when I used to take the test, a 5 was considered like pretty good.
Okay.
Whereas now 5 is just it's okay.
Yeah.
So I think, the number of places is staying stagnant, more applicants, but also I think the quality of applicants is going up as well.
And I think people are starting to think about it a lot earlier than they used to. You know, even over the last couple of years, I've noticed a big shift in terms of when people start thinking, okay, I'm going to apply to university. I need to do X, Y, and Z for that course, for that university that I want to go to.
I had an email inquiry from a really lovely lady from Melbourne.
Okay.
Wanted us to help her daughter get into Oxford for medicine. And when I spoke to her, it essentially transpired. I thought she was in sixth form.
Okay.
Turns out she was 6 months. So she was actually just 6 months old.
What?
So I told her, I said, you're doing the right thing by coming to us, but come to us in about 16 years, Cole.
Yeah. Wow. 6 months. That must have been, you know, I know we like to speak to the student to sort of assess their interest in the subject. That's got to be quite tricky.
Yeah, wow. But I think it just goes to, I think that's an isolated example, but you're right. Like the type of people calling us, they're aware of how competitive it is and they're starting earlier.
Yeah. And I think, you know, sometimes people, and you know, there are some people who I speak to who have gone through the process and have done very well. And they say, you know, but at that stage, I didn't even know what I should be doing.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, you don't have to be doing anything that complex. If you're engaging with your subject that you're going to be, you know, if you're in year 11, 12, if you're engaging with your subject to a degree which is outside of the school level, that in itself is a really good thing to be doing. So people often say, well, yeah, you know, I don't know what to do, or I didn't know what to do. But actually, it's not that, you don't have to be doing something sort of magical. It can be that simple. Or just doing some past papers. You know, there's going to be a very important exam.
Yeah.
You can give the past papers a couple of goes. You don't have to do one a day or anything ludicrous like that. But you can just have a look at it, see the kind of questions that are there, get a sense for if that's something you find hard or easy, and then sort of start doing some things towards it. And of course, if you give yourself a year to do that, you can get away with doing it every now and again. If you give yourself a week to do it, you're going to have a bad week.
Then, yeah, you do have to do 4 papers a day minimum.
Yeah. I do. I think one thing that I would like to see changed, actually, and I don't know if it still is the case, but I'm pretty sure on the UCAT website, it says you only need 4 weeks to prepare. Something along those lines. And I think that's really misleading, because I will speak to students who say, well, it said 4 weeks, so I did 4 weeks and I ended up running out of time and not doing very well. You know, it's not good advice. I think they should be saying you know, you start 4 months in advance, give it a go. If it's really easy, if you get full marks, then you can put it on the back burner. But if it's really hard, you then at least have time to do something about it.
Yeah, and you know, some of the students I speak to now who are applying for 2023 entry, the advice I always give them is take the UCAT a year early, see what you end up with. So we had this one student, she's been working with us since she was in year 10. And last year she was in year 11. She'd sat the UCAT a year early. She was in year 12. She sat a year early. And she did pretty bad at it, to be honest. She was a pretty much, she got perfect GCSEs, perfect scores otherwise, but she only got a 550. Below average.
Yeah.
Then she did it again this year. And I said, look, just a psychologically, you did that with no prep. You've been working on this for a long time. And she absolutely smashed it. So you got 750 average. But I think just having the experience and psychological kind of composure to be able to go into it, knowing that you've sat it before, knowing that you worked on it, it's just a huge, you know, help. So I think, you know, if there are applicants listening, one of the best things that you can do for your application is just to sit your exams a year early when there's essentially no pressure, no high stakes, and then you can always reassess.
And again, you know, it's just the kind of thing that you can only do that if you give yourself it time, and if you're thinking about it ahead of time, basically.
Yeah. Some students I speak to, every now and then they say, well, we can't start preparing for the interviews until we've got the interview invite. They just don't seem to understand the concept that you can't prepare for these kind of tests and interviews with like a week's notice. It just doesn't work that way.
I think so. A number of people that I've spoken to have said that, and they often change their tune once I tell them that actually they'll probably only get like 5 or 6 days notice that they have an interview.
Yeah.
And then they realize, okay, well, we're not going to be able to do it in that time. And actually, you know, you're right. They're sort of, but particularly in an interview, particularly in an academic interview, what they're looking for is sort of a confidence and a fluency in what you're talking about, which you can't really develop just by sort of cramming lots of reading. That's the kind of thing that you can only develop if you've engaged with what you've said. You know, you've said on your personal statement, I'm really interested in X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
If you've engaged with it, you will be able to, you know, the interviews won't be hard. They won't be difficult if you actually know what you're talking about. And that just takes time.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? I think, it's just one of these things that students always underestimate how good they'll be in certain areas and always overestimate other aspects. But
yeah.
I suppose kind of coming back to the kind of competitive nature of admissions going forward, do you think there's a chance that universities will start to raise their grade profiles? I mean, Cambridge, when the A star was first announced, Cambridge used to only ask for one A star and two A's.
Mm.
And then, you know, a few years ago, they changed that to two A stars. And do you think there's a chance we'll start seeing three A star offers?
That's a good question. I mean, so I think for universities, I think it's more likely actually to happen at universities that don't use sort of an elaborate application process. Because I think for Cambridge, actually, having the third A star compared to just two A stars or whatever it is, isn't necessarily that interesting about an individual, whereas having a fantastic score on the NSAA is. But if you don't have that information, if you don't actually speak to your applicants, then that's all you have, right? So you have to lean on it harder. So I would imagine if these other universities don't take on tests, the only other thing they can do is raise the grades that they ask for.
I suppose there comes a point when even the grades just don't mean anything, especially I suppose over the last 2 years. A lot of these students, you know, I think in the article, I actually mentioned the fact that there are students who have not actually sat a competitive test for 2+ years. So GCSEs are kind of difficult, but they're also very character building in the sense they give you a lot of life experience.
Yeah.
If you've never sat a high pressure stakes exam,
yeah,
then what are you going to prepare for? What are you going to be like when you have to sit a UCAT BMAT equivalent, which essentially decides where you end up for the next 5 years of your life.
Or, you know, one thing that I hadn't actually thought about until just now was we talk about the people who, you know, they've not sat GCSEs, so they're not going to know what they're doing for their A-levels. But what about in their first year, second year, third year? when they start having university exams, you know, you've not been, if you've not been through the process of GCSEs and A-levels where you've sort of learned what revision looks like for you, you've learned how to manage your time around it, you've learned how to deal with multiple exams on the same week. If you haven't had that experience, it's pretty rough to go through that for the first time at university. The first year exams don't, I think there were some subjects where the first year exams were credit carrying as well. So do you really want your first examination period to actually be contributing to your overall degree? Probably not.
No, that's true. And I guess, you know, because A-levels don't matter, even if you have been predicted 3 A stars or you've got straight nines at GCSE, I just wonder how realistic universities are actually going to consider those grades to be. And, you know, whether they'll just weigh the tests and interviews more. Because historically, we've always said, you know, depending on the course in university, but generally, broadly speaking, it's 30% test, 30% grade, 30% interview, and 10% everything else. But if the grades essentially don't, kind of sham grades, you know, I think that's quite a strong word, but if they aren't actual achieved grades, or because inflation has made them less valuable, then will they still, do you think they'll adjust the algorithm slightly? So maybe we'll see instead of 30%, like 10%, 20%?
So I do think that is the way that it seems to be going. One thing that the universities aren't very helpful with is like just declaring these things. You know, that there's not really a sense from them, or not a very clear and coherent and reliable sense from universities of, look, guys, we know you're not actually sitting your exams these days. This is how we're going to adjust. Or at least I haven't seen that. You know, we try to put together the sort of the weightings that we see based on sort of data, but you don't get that until 2 years after the fact. And if the universities aren't saying anything either, it's kind of difficult to really make sense of it. But
it is tricky. I think just generally what that means is students are under a lot more mental strain than perhaps they have been in the past. So it's one of those that, yes, wouldn't it be great if you didn't have to take your GCSEs and
stuff?
It sounded really good in theory, but actually in practice, it does kind of disadvantage the kind of top caliber applicants, of course, as well. And there's a background of, you know, we don't have time to kind of go into state versus private schools, but that I think has just made things that, if you kind of copy and paste this onto the background of a increasingly positive discriminatory practice, that kind of also makes things much more difficult, especially for students who've been in private schools, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't fully understand their process for the grade allocation the last year. So I don't know what their process was for sort of auditing and checking, and actually sort of verifying how reliable the given grades are. But even a very impressive system would not actually be able to do, you know, nothing is as good at telling how well someone will do in an exam as sitting an exam. You can't, that's why they're there. That's why they're quite an established process of assessing someone. And I think for the students who perhaps, you know, there are lots of people who maybe don't engage with education super well all the way through the year. Maybe their first year of GCSE is a little off, or their first year of A-levels is a little off, but they want to really throw themselves into it the second year. Something just clicks and they get it and it's all working and they're really going along well with it. Those people are severely disadvantaged because they don't have the opportunity to basically demonstrate, this is what I can do, because they're sort of pulled down by perhaps having a bad first year or even a bad first 18 months. You know, there's plenty of time in 6 months for a switched on student to effectively catch up, but you lose that opportunity completely. I think if it was me, I would not have gotten the grades that I got. I would have gotten probably a fairly worse grades if there'd been sort of the teacher assessed.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think back when I was doing my GCSE maths, I remember being shocked when the first paper I did about 6 weeks before my maths GCSE, I got a B in, and I thought I was decent in maths. And, you know, from there onwards, obviously I went on to get, you know, top marks, but it took a lot of practice to kind of just, I think I did about 15 papers. Again, I love past papers, you can tell. I did about 15 maths papers and I got myself up to an A star.
Yeah.
But you're right. I think if my school teachers had predicted me based on a mock result, that would have really, really not done me justice. So
yeah.
Interesting, isn't it?
On the topic of maths, my in A level, I was doing very, very badly. So I did maths and further maths. Mm-hmm. And what we did at my school was we did the whole maths A level in 1 year and then the whole further maths A level the next year. And I got to the end of my first year.
That seems a bit painful to do that way. Controversial.
I mean, it was fine. I guess some of the...
You were doing badly.
Well, yeah. Apart from the fact that I was doing really, really badly, it was fine. So there were two modules, C3 and C4, which is just like core 3 and core 4. I'm pretty sure that's what it stands for.
Yeah.
And my teacher, I thought, for whatever reason, I wasn't understanding what she was trying to teach. And it just wasn't clicking with me.
Mm-hmm.
And through the year, I did terribly on those tests. I was told by my school to not do further maths, so it was bad. And then in the end, I think I got a B or a C in C3 and C4. And then so I resat both those modules the following year and did further maths. But I just because I sort of sat down and was like, okay, no, I have to do this now. And I self-taught myself C3 and C4. I ended up getting an A star in maths. I got an A in further maths. And I actually got full marks. Like, I didn't drop a mark in the C3 exam that I did the second year round.
I can't imagine you getting a C.
I remember one that the sort of... We did a test sort of near to the end... Well, near to the end of the spring term. And this was the test which afterwards I was told to drop further maths. And I got 8 marks out of 40. So I wasn't doing very well at the time.
They were very generous to give you a C with 20%.
No. So that was a different... I think I wasn't given a grade for that, actually.
You got a U, and I'm graded.
Yeah, it was tough. And, you know, again, if I'd just been allocated grades, wasn't given that opportunity to sort of self-teach, sit the test myself, do it, I would have ended up with much lower grades.
Yeah. Who needs teachers anyways, right? Like, you just teach ourselves.
Get a book, learn it yourself, easy peasy, job done.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think overall, what we're seeing, I think we're, because you sort of, when I talk about this with people, there's a sense of, you know, we are as competitive, or like this is the most competitive it's ever been. And it is, but we're actually sort of just, it's only just beginning really. Or the way that I see it, it's only going to get harder to get into university. It's only going to get more competitive. There's only going to be more hurdles. It's not going to get easier.
Mm.
And so I think people who are serious about it need to work on it. They need to think about it properly. You know, you don't have to. University isn't necessarily the best place for everyone to go. I was listening to a Radio 4 show. And I think they were saying between 20 and 30% of people who graduate with a degree end up sort of, I can't exactly remember how they measured this, but end up sort of no better off because of it. The job that they go into didn't need it.
Yeah, it's just such a huge debt that you take on, of course. And, you know, to pay that debt off takes a long time. So, I get it. Yeah, interesting. So space, you know, if we start wrapping up here, the kind of general feeling is that things have been getting harder just over the last 10 years or so anyway.
Yeah.
But the COVID kind of accelerated things through a multifactorial approach of students are preparing earlier, they're preparing harder, and there's more applicants for essentially the same number of places. So the competition ratios get increasingly harder, added onto a background of COVID uncertainty, which has caused a course from, you know, there were 5 years ago, there were actually places in clearing for medicine, believe it or not.
Yeah.
Whereas now it's just completely unthinkable. to the extent where actually probably a significant portion of next year's space is already filled. So generally, I think we can agree the students do need to start earlier, work harder. But is there an element of also the universities need to do a bit more?
Well, and I was just thinking, when was the last time that a university was made a Russell Group University? Because I think it's sort of been about, I'm Googling it now. It's been almost 10 years since the last Russell Group University was made a Russell Group University. Okay. So it's not just a, you know, if people want to go to good universities, they can only, you know, increase their year cohorts by a small amount each year. What is going to increase the places is actually having more like top tier universities, but that's not, that doesn't seem to be happening. Obviously new universities are being built, but since 2012, no one has been deemed sort of strong enough to be a Russell Group. You know, I don't know if they decided we would not add any more on. That seems a bit strange to me, but you know, that's another factor. People want to go to, you know, if you're going to go to university, they want to go to Russell Group University, and that list isn't getting longer.
Very interesting. Yeah, I suppose if more people are going to university, but the number of places just in the UK isn't increasing, then there will come a point upon which it just becomes like an increasingly valued resource.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting what you mentioned, because, you know, as you said, there are few, if you're doing, I don't know, Timbuktu studies in the University of Bury-on-Tweed, then like your job prospects, I would question whether that you'd be better off just doing a 3-year apprenticeship, for example. Yep. So I do think certain degrees make you much more employable and set you up for life. Whereas I think others are just essentially, I don't think university is for everyone. I think it's important that we actually tell people that there are other options available to them.
Yeah. And I think where the issue for that is, it doesn't lie with the universities, it doesn't lie with individuals, it kind of lies with schools. I don't think all schools do a very good job of explaining to young students, look, if what do you want to do with your life? If you want to do X, then actually university really is the best place for you. If you want to do Y, then actually there's a really good apprenticeship, or there's a government scheme, or whatever it is. From my experience at school, that definitely wasn't it. It was, you know, go to university. And, you know, I think whether you're a school that sends, who has no one who applies to university, or the other way around, you know, no one doesn't apply to university, I still think you need to set the precedent of, look, it's not just everyone does the same thing. It really depends on you. Whatever you want to do, we will support you and give you the information you need to be able to do that. I don't think schools do that at the moment.
Yeah. You know, I think it's hard for schools because they're meant, particularly like the top tier private schools, they're meant to be the schools that get students into Oxbridge.
Yeah.
If you think of like Eton, their success rate's just been hammered. So they used to get more than 100 students in only 5 years ago. And now they're getting less than half that. And
yeah.
So naturally, with a school like that, there's a lot of pride. So they're very reluctant to admit that actually it is getting increasingly difficult.
Yeah.
Especially for students from private schools. It's just, that's undeniable.
Yeah. I would like to say, obviously, that I understand that for a lot of schools, providing a service like the service I was talking about would be so much work and would take a lot of time that they don't have, and they don't have resources for. Because, you know, there's lots of state schools who, you know, fantastic. Yeah. Why don't we have a careers department? Why don't we have all this information? But actually, who's going to do it and how are we going to fund it?
Yeah.
But yeah, I actually think that's sort of, that is a really important thing. You know, places like Eton will have a careers department.
Well, they'll probably have their own in-house uni admissions, I suspect.
So. Yeah. No, they'll have a few people on the team. I can't connect to the public Wi-Fi. Oh, that's my Alexa. Shush, Alexa. I haven't been able to set her up yet, but she keeps going off every now and again. It is tough. I think careers guidance is something which is actually a lot harder than it sounds. It sort of sounds like a... you know, I didn't really spend that much time in my careers department at school. I sort of couldn't be bothered. But actually, it's really important and it's difficult to do right.
Yeah, absolutely. So probably time to start wrapping up, which I said, I know, about 5 minutes ago, but we'll actually start wrapping up now. Have you got a fun fact for us this week?
Well, like I said earlier, I can rustle one up. So I was reading, as I often am these days doing my master's, reading about the brain. And I need to read more about this actually, because it's very interesting. But apparently axolotls have, I don't know if they have it, but it's something called neoteny. And it, basically they don't age, or they don't show signs of aging in the way that we age, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So axolotls are these small, like, so they're sort of lizardy. They've got weird, like, fronds on the top of their heads, and they're quite, like, they're, like, sort of pale pink. I think they live in caves, and I'm pretty sure they breathe CO2. And I'm sure you're probably thinking I'm making this all up.
Yeah, I was actually going to say, it sounds like you're making this up.
But they do exist. And
why are you learning about these in neuroscience?
Well, so what I was reading was not about axolotls, but it was talking about neuroregeneration.
Uh-huh. You went down the wiki hole, didn't you?
Well, you can end up, I do. There are two things that I need to read about. Firstly, neoteny and axolotls, and also the neuroregenerative properties of Schwann cells. So I'm really, you know, I'm enjoying university quite a lot.
I wrote an essay on that topic.
Did you?
Yeah, I can give it to you for a fee.
Yeah, we were just in a lecture and we were talking about it, and I sort of asked the lecturer a few more questions about it. Sounds really interesting. But not something I'd heard of before.
I didn't do very well in the essay. I think I only got a 2-2. So
okay.
It's better than nothing if you can.
Yeah, definitely. No, I would read that. I'd absolutely read it. But anyway, so axolotls apparently don't age. That's what I've got.
So they're lizards that don't age, essentially, is your opinion?
I think, yes.
How big are they?
Oh, small. Like, sort of.
Can you see them with the naked eye?
You can see them with, yeah. So I would say they're probably the size of like a bottle of deodorant or something, like a water bottle, that kind of size. Quite
a water bottle. That's pretty big.
Well, I guess thinner than a. I don't know. You Google them at some point.
There you go, listeners. If you'd like to know more, then Google it.
Yeah. If the information that we're giving here is completely poorly explained, then you can just sort of learn about it somewhere else.
Will's been doing frantic things with his hands this entire time, but unfortunately, that can't be captured.
Yeah, I do find it difficult to express myself without. I'm quite fiddly. So
are they ever? Do they? I mean, when they're born, do they age, or are they just born adult?
That's a good question. I think they age until they're an adult.
And like elves.
They are effectively elves, yeah. I'm not sure if it's the... It might just be... Because as I understand it, aging is effectively where our cells sort of split, but they sort of get worse at it as you go through life. Is that kind of a really bad way of explaining it?
Yeah, I don't think that's a bad way. Essentially, every time your cells multiply, your the DNA in those cells becomes shorter. And there comes a point when essentially cells can't keep replicating. Okay. Because then you start losing critical functions of DNA, which would then be useful for the cell. So it's known as the Hayflick limit. But I feel like I'm encroaching on your turf here, so I'll stop there.
Yeah, that's right. So I think what it is when their cells divide, they maintain all the DNA then.
Oh, that is interesting.
That which is interesting. I think that's it. I'll read again and double check.
In 10 years' time, we may see some axolotl cream coming to
absolutely. Like, so I'm quite keen on. Did you ever see the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man film with the lizard professor?
Yeah.
I'm quite keen on sort of. You know, following in his footsteps.
Was he an axolotl?
It wasn't an axolotl, no. It was just, I don't know why. So it was because lizards can regrow limbs as well.
Yeah,
Lizards can do crazy things.
They can, can't they? Maybe we should have an episode on lizards, the fun life of lizards.
I could do that. Yeah, yeah, I'll have to. I'll definitely have to do a lot more reading. I'm out of lizard information now.
We'd need a zombie. Yeah, maybe zombie lizards would be nice.
Zombie lizards. Yeah. Have you got a fact?
I do. Mine ties into your computer sciences.
Okay.
Reference earlier, which is there's something called Moore's Law, which essentially says the kind of. Are you familiar with Moore's Law at all? No. So essentially, it says that computing processing power will double every 18 months.
Okay, okay.
Essentially what that means is the number of processors that can fit into a finite space will increase by a factor of two every 18 months. So they'll be able to squeeze in more and more microprocessors into the same volume of space every 18 months. And when this first started, it was a prediction. I think it was like the 90s. But essentially it became so true that now Intel, IBM, when they launch their products, they'll artificially wait to actually launch their products so that they essentially it lines up with Moore's Law. So even if the product is ready earlier, they won't launch it until later. But the kind of real, I mean, that's kind of all theoretical. But the real life application of that is if you imagine if a similar phenomena could be true for like other non-electronic parts like car motors, for example, and Moore's Law applied to car motors, it would be so cheap to essentially have a car that whenever you got out of your car, you wouldn't park it carefully in a drive or a parking lot. You would just throw it away. And then that whenever you needed to go somewhere, you'd have a car in your pocket, which you could then inflate or go to a car vending machine and buy. And it would just be pennies rather than tens of thousands of pounds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which I think is quite interesting. So essentially imagine if the certain phenomena could be observed and applied across to a different industry, what the impact of that would be. So it's just, yes, essentially it's a factor of exponential growth over 20 years.
I mean, you do, and naturally it's going to lead to sort of wasteful behavior, right? If it's cheaper to just make another one.
Yeah, I mean.
But you see that in phones, you know, you see that already. Quite a lot.
Did you know have you heard this? I mean, this, I should probably save this, but the total computing power required to get man on the moon in the Apollo landings in 69 was less than you have on your smartphone right now.
It's much more effective use, isn't it?
I mean, I couldn't get man on the moon with my phone.
Right? I would really struggle.
Yeah. Even, I mean, I think I'd struggle with just Googling it and seeing how did we get man on the moon.
Yeah. That's nuts.
Yeah. So it's amazing what you can do, but I think we just start taking things for granted when they start getting to this level of
definitely
access, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, anything else?
No. I'm going to have to read about lizards and find some more facts.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, I'll see you soon.
Take care.